Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today's guest is neither rich nor famous. Chances are you've never heard of him. In fact, these are the words of an award-winning journalist and author, Michael Castleman. He is an author who specializes in health and sexuality. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Michigan with a degree in English and earned a master's in journalism at UC Berkeley. Over the past 50 years, he has written 3,000 magazine and web articles, 15 nonfiction books, and 4 mystery novels. His bi-monthly blog on psychologytoday.com, All About Sex, has had more than 60 million views. Michael Castleman's 19th book is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing. Michael Castleman, welcome.
Nancy, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, your book is interesting in so many ways. For example, I open the book and page one, and actually I appreciate the fact that you use just numerals throughout. You don't start with Roman numerals like some books do. You just give us Arabic numerals to begin with. So I open it to page one, and I see 6 blurbs. And then I turn the page, and I see 7 blurbs. I turn the page, and I see 8 blurbs. Turn the page, 6 blurbs, and then 4 blurbs. Michael, I have never seen a book with 31 blurbs in it before. I thought maybe that was partly your sense of humor.
No, it's just an attempt to get a little attention in a publishing environment where that's very, very difficult to do and increasingly difficult because there's so many books being published. You know, every book, most books have a few blurbs, 1 or 2 on the back cover.
Yeah, you know. That's the usual.
And people just don't even, they're like wallpaper. They don't really matter. But when you have 38 blurbs, maybe somebody's going to notice. For example, you, Nancy, you did notice. So I guess those blurbs did their job.
Well, I didn't know that blurb was also a verb. In fact, in your book, you say, I've blurbed friends' books generously, and they've graciously reciprocated. So blurb, I didn't know the background of that. The word blurb, I've known for a long time. Where did we get that word blurb?
The word blurb dates from the year 1907. And in the early 20th century, publishers stopped binding books in leather covers. In the 19th century, hardback books had leather covers, and leather was expensive. So in the early 20th century, publishers switched to cloth-covered cardboard, the kind of hard covers we have today, and then they covered those cardboard covers in paper dust jackets that they could put color printing on and make the cover of a book like a mini billboard to attract attention. So initially, they had these dust jackets with the billboard cover, and the back cover, they had the teaser copy, you know, trying to suck people in why you should read this book. And the flaps that went around the cardboard cover were left blank. And then pretty quickly, by 1910 or so, the publishing community began putting the teaser copy on the flaps, leaving the back cover blank. And they thought, well, what should we do with it? And they thought, well, how about promotional quotes from notables? And so they started going after quotes. And of course, the quotes, like most blurbs, are rather extravagant. You know, this is God's gift to literature. Bibliophiles and librarians and educators objected to these promotional quotes, saying they're extravagant, they're insults to our intelligence, they're lies. And there was a big kerfuffle, culturally speaking. Around 1907, things came to a head, and a satirist in San Francisco named Frank Burgess published a collection of satirical essays. And as a joke on the back cover, he made up an unbelievably over-the-top, super extravagant quote that he attributed to a fictional admirer named Belinda Blurb. And ever since then, promotional quotes have been called blurbs, as a noun and as a verb, to blurb someone.
My guest is Michael Castleman, and I'm asking him about his most recent book, The Untold Story of Books. And as a bibliophile myself, I found every page so fascinating. I learned something, and I learned a lot. In fact, I was thinking, Michael, you could add teacher to your resume, I think. In fact, the very first time I met you, you came to Chico State campus and you gave a talk. And as I recall, it was on how to be a freelance writer. Because a lot of times being a writer is not the most lucrative profession to have. But you had some really good tips on how to be a freelance writer. Am I accurate in that in recalling your talk about that?
Yeah. I've never made a living writing books. Very, very few people make livings writing books. Maybe 1,000 Americans out of the millions who write books. But I did make a living as a writer. I was a magazine journalist, and I made a living for 35 years writing magazine articles, which I enjoyed doing a great deal. It was fun. But it was also a business. And the problem with a lot of freelance writers is that they don't take it seriously as a business. They think that writers and artists somehow stand apart from the business world, which of course is ridiculous because we're all involved in commerce. We're all involved in business. And so I decided that the way to make it as a writer was to become a sort of micro entrepreneur. You're in business, you have to promote that business, you have to market that business, you have to sell your product, you have to collect the money that's owed you. It's a business. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. In fact, I saw a lot that was fascinating about it. And it's that kind of sensibility that that impelled me to study the business side of the book business. Most authors don't really understand much about the business side of publishing. And ever since there have been literary agents, which also dates from the early 20th century, a lot of writers said, hey, I don't have to worry about the business side. My agent will handle that. Well, yes, agents are good at some aspects of the business. But agents don't sign your book contracts and they are not obligated by the responsibilities therein. So my advice to authors is take the business side very seriously. It's very hard to make a book in the writing game. And ignoring the business side only makes it harder.
And that did come across. I recall that in the talk that you gave on the Chico State campus. And also, it comes across in your book. I feel like you're teaching us a lot about the book publishing business. And so that seemed to be why you wrote this book. What was your mission when you wrote The Untold Story of Books?
Well, my mission all along was to learn more about the publishing industry so that I could prosper within it. And I signed my first book contract in 1979, so that's 44 years ago. And I immediately began reading everything I could get my hands on about book publishing, and I have continued to do that through ever since then. And I had no thought of writing a book about it. I wasn't really interested in writing a sort of business book or biography of a business. But in the year 2000, right around the millennium, the book publishing model of the 20th century, which I call industrial publishing, gave way to what we have now, which is digital publishing, and it upended everything. Books look the same. Books produced in 2024 look exactly the same as books produced in 1975. But everything behind those books has been changed by the digital revolution. And as that was happening, I thought, oh my God, I don't know what's going on here. And everybody I knew, all the authors I knew, were confused and flummoxed, even more confused than authors usually are. And so at that point, I got a little more serious about writing a book about this. And in fact, this is the longest book project of my life. Most of my other books took a year or two to write. This one took 18 years in 4 drafts, and was quite a struggle for me. And this book has been more heavily edited than any book I've ever written. And I think that's been a good thing, actually. I mean, it was frustrating that it took so long, but the editing really helped shape it into what I wanted it to be, which was a light and breezy, entertaining but informative look at a business that is very much mythologized and that people make all kinds of assumptions about, most of which are not true. So I was interested in discerning the truth and sharing it.
And I think you succeeded in making it humorous and pleasant. And while we were learning, you're making us laugh, made me laugh. For example, the dedication of your book, you dedicate to your parents, for example, who once asked, "A writer? How on earth will you make a living?" And apparently they accepted that. And you said, I think it was your wife, the dedication. She never said, "Mike, get a job." So right. You had support for this desire that you had to write. You even later in the book tell us the origin of book dedications. I was surprised how far back that tradition goes. When did books start getting dedications in them?
Book dedications date back to ancient Rome, where this was before the printing press, before there were publishers. And the few writers that there were, you know, guys like Pliny the Elder and, you know, they wrote their manuscripts on scrolls. But to have them copied was very expensive, and they couldn't afford to have their scrolls copied. And so they appealed to rich patrons who would pay to have the scrolls copied and reproduced so that they could be not widely disseminated, but at least somewhat disseminated. And so in gratitude, the authors had a dedication to the patron right up front. And that lasted through that into the 19th century. People were still dedicating books to their financial patrons. But in the 20th century, that faded as the publishing world evolved and publishers started paying authors for manuscripts. At that point, dedications changed into what they are today, which is just appreciations of people who authors hold dear. But it lost its financial connotation most of the time. Some people still have financial patrons and thank them in their dedications.
My guest is Michael Castleman, and his latest book is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, journalist and author Michael Castleman. And his latest book is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing. And I mentioned that I think you use the word breezy for your book, Michael. And in your introduction, you start out with a couple of jokes. And two old jokes crystallize the book business. What's the difference between an author and an extra-large pizza? An extra-large pizza can feed a family. And then you have another joke. How do you make a small fortune in publishing? Start with a large one. And when I read your two books, I thought of something that I used to say, and I was married to an author, and he did so much research that he had tons of books that he would get to do his research. So I began to wonder, how many books does it take to write a book?
Yeah.
And he was fortunate because his first book, he didn't have to go out looking for a publisher. They knocked on his office door and said, do you have anything we can publish? Those were the days. That was a very long time ago, because you outline what it's like now to try to get a book published. Oh, my goodness.
And well, yeah. There are still cases today where publishers approach authors and say, hey, you know, we read this that you did. Would you want to write a book about it? That still does happen, but a lot less than it used to. And it's only now a tiny, tiny percentage of books. I mean, today we are drowning in 2 million new books a year because the digital revolution has made books easier to publish than ever before, but harder to promote and sell. There are just so many books, you can't even wade through it. I mean, during the time that we are talking here to each other, Nancy, probably 500 books are gonna be published in the United States. 7,000 books are published every day just in the United States. So we have a whole new world since the millennium, and digital publishing. And the fact this huge change it didn't go unnoticed. People noticed it. Digital has changed everything in our lives. But authors were confused. And that was why I felt like, not that I have all the answers, but I felt like I had some insights into what was happening. And I'm gratified that The Untold Story of Books has been very well received by authors who often say, oh, my God, I never knew any of this.
Well,
so I'm glad.
Now, I did enjoy back when times were simpler, Michael. For example, you take us back to Socrates. And I thought, oh, Socrates, this great guy. But you said he had mixed feelings about literacy. And he said, oh, but if we have writing, we're going to be forgetful and people are going to tell falsehoods. So you take us through back when Plato was saying, maybe literacy is not such a good idea. And you also mentioned manuscripts. And we can kind of guess if we study Latin, I studied Latin in high school, where the word manuscript comes from. But I had no idea where the word title comes from. How do we get that word title, Michael?
Title is an English corruption of the Latin word titulus, T-I-T-L-U-S, which means tag. And, you know, there were lots of writers and scribes writing scrolls in the ancient world. And all those scrolls were rolled up and put into little cubbies in ancient libraries, where they all looked exactly the same. And librarians could not figure out where they had put things. So they affixed little tags to one end of the scroll, a titulus, with a couple of words that would, you know, hint at what the manuscript was. And that evolved into our word title, which is how we crystallize the contents of a book by saying the title.
Well, so many things in your book fascinated me that I'd have to stop and go look up other information just in my own house. For example, hanging on my wall is a parchment. It's a skin, and it's in Latin. It has music notes on it. And when I read about this transition of why they say, yeah, you know what? When we have scrolls, we're only using one side of the paper or parchment. And so I went and looked at my framed parchment on my wall, and it'd been a long time since I'd really carefully looked at it, and I could see the printing on the other side. So I know this was well after they started using both sides of a parchment.
Right. Yeah, the parchment is animal skin. And before there was paper in the West, scrolls were written on animal skin, and it was very costly because any decent book required the slaughtering of a whole herd of cattle. So parchment was very difficult to work with too. You had to hammer it, you had to soak it in lye. I mean, it was a mess. Parchment, the other thing about parchment was that scrolls only used one side of the parchment. So around the year 100 CE, during Roman times, unknown ancient scribes decided, can we do something different? So they took a scroll and they cut it into rectangular sheets.
That's what mine is. Mine's a rectangle.
And they sewed one side of the sheets together to form a primitive book, which is called a codex. And then they realized, oh my God, we could use both sides of the parchment. And so parchment was thick enough so that writing on one side did not bleed over to the other side. So you could use both sides. And in one fell swoop, they cut their parchment costs in half. And the entire history of the book business is all about fewer people being able to produce more copies of more books faster and cheaper. And one of the ways you make books cheaper is to make the component parts cheaper. So, for example, using parchment on both sides. And then after parchment, when paper was introduced, actually paper was invented in China and then slowly migrated west across India and the Arab world. And it was traders Greece and Rome and Egypt who were trading with Arab traders who had paper, who introduced paper into Europe. And paper was costly, but it was a lot less than parchment because you didn't have to kill a herd of cattle for a book.
There were so many things in your book that I thought, oh, I never would have imagined that. For example, the world's first author known by name was a woman.
Yes.
And I had no idea how far back that went.
And that was about, as I recall, it was around 2000 BC, and the woman in question was a priestess in ancient Sumer, a Sumerian priestess, at a time when very few religious figures were women, and it's fairly clear that the reason she ascended to the priesthood was that she was the daughter of the king. So this princess decided she wanted to be a priest, and the Sumerian government said okay. And what she did was she wrote prayers for women who were in search of mates, who were lovelorn, and some of those prayers survive with her name, which I can't even pronounce.
Oh, gosh, yes.
But she is this woman who is generally recognized now to be the oldest, the first author who is known to us today by name.
You also say that if you were a printer, your life could be in danger. You cite a French printer who was executed. He was burned at the stake. If the monarchy was
That's
displeased,
right.
You didn't want to do that. Another thing, when you tell us things about Ben Franklin, one of our heroes back in the colonial days was Benjamin Franklin. Well, he was a liar, too.
Yes.
You tell us that he would use a pseudonym to criticize other authors.
Yes, all printers did that in the colonial America. Printing was a very tough business, and a lot of printers went bankrupt. ever since Gutenberg, he went bankrupt. Since from day one, the book publishing industry has been a minefield, not for the faint of heart. But Franklin did what all colonial printers did, which was he published a newspaper. And in that newspaper, he wrote most of the articles under pseudonyms. And he would use pseudonyms to criticize the output of other printers and call them jerks and idiots and terrible craftsmen. And this was just the way it was. It was like, you know, like sports trash talk. That's the way printers related to one another, because they were in desperate competition for work, for people who would pay them to print things. And printing was expensive. So Franklin did what they all did, which was put down the competition.
Well, also being a proud American, I assume that it was in America that the first printing press was in the New World, and that wasn't the case. You say that we didn't get a printing press until 1638 in Cambridge, here in the what was not the United States yet, but here in America. And who had the first printing press?
The Catholic Church in Mexico City. Mexico City was had printing presses almost 100 years before they appeared in North America. The Spanish government, you know, the Spanish colonial empire was enormous, and Spain had printing operations in Mexico City that mostly printed religious tracts and government documents. It wasn't like there were bookstores in Mexico City in 1550, but there were printing presses, and they were churning out religious material for the Catholic Church and government documents for the government that ran a far-flung empire in the New World.
Well, we did mention Gutenberg's Bibles, for example, so we know the Bible was one of the main books, but you also tell us there was another book in colonial homes here in America, the Bible and almanacs. And you right. even tell us where that word comes from. I was happy to hear that that was Greek for calendar.
Yes, almanacs were a staple of early publishing, and they had calendars, they had tide charts, they had advice about when to plant and when to reap. They had, you know, sort of practical information, the phases of the moon, holidays, and then they also had editorial content. They had sermons, and they had other sayings. I mean, Poor Richard's Almanac was the most famous one. That was Benjamin Franklin's. And he filled it with aphorisms like early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. That all came from almanacs. And the thing about almanacs that was great for printers in the colonial world was that everybody, if your house had any book at all, it was a Bible. But once you had a Bible, you had the Bible. The Bible never changed. I mean, the Bible was always the Bible. So if you bought one, you didn't really have to buy two. But with almanacs, wealthy book buyers bought one every year because they wanted to know when the tides would come in this year, and when the phases of the moon were this year, and when the holidays were this year. And so almanacs became a staple of printers throughout the 13 colonies because they were big money makers. And in fact, the oldest continuously printed book in the United States dates from, I believe, 1790 or something. And it's the Old Farmer's Almanac, published in New Hampshire, as it has been for almost 300 years.
Well, I was shocked when you tell us the oldest, most valuable American book. I had no idea. And you say the most ever paid for a book, this was in 2013, one of these books sold for $14 million. What in the world, what book would somebody pay $14 million for, Michael?
Well, it was the Bay Psalm book. And the this was a book of the Book of Psalms of the Bible. And psalms were often read in churches, and so psalms were prayers, as well as poetry. And when the first printing press was established in the United States, in what became the United States, in Boston in around 1638, as I recall, it was set up to print material for student ministers at Harvard College, which had been set up a couple years before. And so this printing press was set up in Boston and was printing things for, you know, the clergy, including the Book of Psalms. And the Bay Psalm book was printed with, I believe it was a run of about 1,000 copies. And, but it was ephemeral. It was considered, you know, no one thought, oh, this is, you know, the first book printed in the New World and in English colonies. It was just in sort of everyday object. And today there are only 14 of them left. And so two of them were held by a church in Boston. In fact, the church that Benjamin Franklin was baptized in. And when that church needed to be renovated, they looked around and thought, well, how are we going to raise the money? And so what they did was they sold one of their Bay Psalm books. I don't even know who the buyer was, but they sold it for $14 million. And the Bay Psalm book is rarer than Gutenberg Bibles. There are a lot more Gutenberg Bibles than there are Psalm books. And there are a lot more first folios of Shakespeare than there are of Bay Psalm books. And so the Bay Psalm book is this Book of Psalms is the most valuable book ever produced in the United States.
After a break, Michael Castleman and I will be back to continue our conversation about his latest book, The Untold Story of Books. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, award-winning journalist and author Michael Castleman, and we're talking about a writer's history of book publishing. Well, there are so many things that I thought, oh, I didn't know that. For example, I've heard of Goody Two Shoes, and I thought, well, this is a book for children. I didn't know it went back to 1765. This story about this little girl, and who was Goody Two Shoes?
Goody Two Shoes was sort of the Nancy Drew of her era.
Oh yeah, I was a Nancy Drew fan.
Goody Two Shoes was a book that extended the genre of romance fiction. So today, romance fiction is the number one category of fiction. It is. Romance fiction is always the story of a naive young woman who is faced with a number of challenges and who rises above adversity to conquer her challenges and meet the man of her dreams and turn the guy into her husband. And that is the arc of virtually all romance fiction. And then romance fiction comes in dozens of different subgenres. But it's all about the triumph of women over adversity. And so when romance fiction had been around for about 50 years, someone got the bright idea to say, hey, maybe we could write some books about young girls, girl children who triumph over adversity. And that might have an audience, and it had a huge audience. And so Goody Two Shoes was the name of one of the first children's books. And Goody was a young girl who was so poor that she didn't have two shoes. She only could afford one shoe. But by dint of tremendous industriousness, she earned a little money and bought a second shoe. And she was so happy, she went dancing around the town and became known as Goody Two Shoes. Now, today, a Goody Two Shoes is someone who is insufferably moral. And it's a put down. It's a pejorative. But back when Goody Two Shoes was all the rage, which it was wildly popular with children, in boys and girls. It was not just popular with girls. Boys loved the stories because Goody Two Shoes solves crimes. She establishes a school for orphans. She's really quite the hero.
Teaches herself to read, you say?
Teaches herself to read. Yeah, yeah. She's
overcomes amazing accusations of witchcraft.
Yeah, so she was, as a fictional character, she's really quite amazing. And nobody knows. You know, you call someone a Goody Two Shoes, it's a put down, but that's not how it started.
In fact, you tell us that the Harry Potter books, Mary Poppins, The Chronicles of Narnia, and much of today's juvenile fiction owe a debt to the not at all overly virtuous little girl with one shoe.
Right, right. Yeah, Goody Two Shoes really launched children's literature. Until Goody Two Shoes, children's literature was like Aesop's fables and, and you know, Grimm's fairy tales, that kind of stuff. But there weren't books about young kids making their mark in the world and triumphing over adversity. So Goody Two Shoes, it was pretty amazing.
You also tell us what the main profession of some of these writers that we know in our history here in the United States, like Washington Irving was a lawyer, and James Fenimore Cooper sailed with the Navy. What are some of these others that, some of them we know, but some of we didn't, what they did, for example, Louisa May Alcott, you say, was a governess. And Thoreau, I do remember this, worked in his family's pencil factory.
Right.
And you made this point earlier that you can't, if you want to be a writer, you cannot expect that to be more than a sideline for you, that you would have other professions.
Yes. You know, the myth is that with hard work and a little luck and talent, you can make a living as an author. Well, you know, Stephen King can.
Yes.
John Grisham can, and Colleen Hoover can, Nora Roberts. But as I mentioned, only about 1,000 Americans at most make a living writing books, while there are 2 million books published every year. So in the last 5 years, we've got 10 million books published, and 1,000 people make a living from it. Everybody else has to view book writing as not as a career, but as an expensive hobby. It's like world travel or playing golf or owning a horse or a boat. I mean, you can get a lot of joy from world travel and playing golf, and it's worth the money that you spend. And if you're an author and you love to write, well, you're going to pursue your hobby. But you also need an income. And so my advice to anyone who wants to be an author is first get yourself a good job so that you can have an income and you can have some discretionary funds with which you can support your writing, because chances are your writing is going to cost you more money than it's going to make you.
Well, I remember this quote by Henry David Thoreau. He wrote in his diary, "I now have a library of nearly 900 volumes, over 700 of which I wrote myself." And right. I remember that quote. But now here's a quote I did not know, I wouldn't have suspected. And you quote an English author, Samuel Johnson, in his Dictionary of the English Language. He defined pirate. And when you say the word pirate, I think of a guy, maybe a patch over his eye and a swashbuckling guy on a ship. He says pirate, he defines it as any robber, particularly a bookseller who seizes the copies of other men. I would never have known it meant specifically a bookseller who seizes the copies of other men. And that's a big problem.
The entire book business was founded on piracy, the theft of intellectual property. And, you know, when books were published in England, they were shipped to the United States, and Benjamin Franklin and all the other printers just seized them and printed them without paying any licensing fee. There were no copyrights. I mean, there were copyrights. They were ignored. And it was just a free-for-all. And even today, I mean, copyright is an ideal, but it's very difficult to enforce, and it's largely an illusion. I mean, I just had three of my books stolen last year by a database called Books 3 Dataset, which is a large collection of text that has been used to train artificial intelligence systems. And artificial intelligence is a misnomer. It should be called plagiarism software, because what they do is they just digest copyrighted material. They don't pay for it. I didn't see a dime. Three of my books were just absorbed by the Books 3 data set. I didn't give permission. I didn't see a nickel from it. And so copyright has always been basically an illusion. And the book business was founded on stealing books from authors. And authors have always been really irritated by it. But there's just not a whole lot you can do. I mean, it's so expensive to pursue someone in court. And then when you win, it's just hard to collect anything. So the book business is, people think it's honorable. People think that it's that books are exalted among consumer products. Books are exalted products, and that the people who manufacture them must be kind of exalted themselves. Well, some are, but many are not. Many are just, flat out pirates who steal other people's work and print it and call it their own.
Yeah, and this notion of piracy is, it goes back a long time, but it really has not come to the forefront until this, what you refer to as the third book business. In your book, you describe these three eras, periods of the book business, and we've indirectly referred to them, but why don't you tell us so we'll know what are these transitions? What caused a transition from one book business to the next?
Well, the whole history of publishing is the history of innovations in printing. And as printing evolved, and as fewer people could produce more copies of more books faster and cheaper using new machinery, that's what has driven the changes in the book business from day one. So when Gutenberg replaced scribes, he threw all these scribes out of work, and being a scribe was a pretty good job. But the printing press was so efficient that it threw them all out of work within one generation, and the cost of books dropped dramatically because mechanically printed books were a lot cheaper to produce than scribes, paying scribes to copy them. And so over time, books got cheaper, and there were more of them around, so there could be more readers and more people could be writers. The first book business dates from Gutenberg to the 1890s, the late 19th century, and they used hand-operated presses like Gutenberg's. Now, Gutenberg's press was very primitive, and over the subsequent 200 or 300 years, those presses became a lot better, a lot faster, and instead of wood, they were made out of metal. But they were still slow. In the 1870s, industrial printing took hold, and industrial printing used enormous steam-driven printing presses that could print books in the blink of an eye. And there were so many books being printed that printers, who had been the publishers, just left publishing and just were printers. All they could do was sort of handle these huge presses, and a whole new profession of publisher sprang up. And in the 20th century, we had these new publishers starting to pay authors for manuscripts. Before the 20th century, authors would pay printers to print their books. There were no publishers. So, you know, Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott and, Uncle Tom's Cabin, all these books were just printed privately. But in the 20th century, publishing grew into a semblance of what it is today. And all of a sudden, publishers were paying authors for manuscripts. And that became known as traditional publishing, but it only lasted 80 years of the 575 years of the book business. So-called traditional publishing only lasted from 1920 until around 2000. And then in 2000, with digital publishing, we still have publishers, and they still pay some authors for manuscripts. But overwhelmingly, the vast majority of authors pay to publish now, and they either hire publishing services companies, which is in the book trade, it's known as hybrid publishing. So it's a company that publishes books, but the author pays them to do it. And then some people self-publish, using ebooks on Amazon. Kindle Direct Publishing is the main publisher in the United States of direct to ebook. And so today, the vast majority of authors are doing a sort of high-tech update of what authors did before 1900, which was pay to get published. And that's what, only about 0.5% of authors now get advances, which is payments before the book comes out. The vast majority, 99.5% of authors, pay to publish their books. And so it's a return to what we had before traditional publishing. And that seems to be the model going forward, that authors will pay to publish.
My guest is award-winning journalist and author Michael Castleman, and he is telling us the untold story of books, a writer's history of book publishing. And I was also interested in the role that relationships to the book publishing industry that I'd never made connections. For example, I knew about Eli Whitney's inventing what we call gin, and you tell us it was originally, the word was engine, and his cotton gin played a role in the way books were constructed. And then what did the cotton gin make possible?
Well, the cotton gin removed the seeds from cotton so efficiently that cotton became the biggest crop in the southern states of America, and one of America's biggest exports was cotton. And if you take cotton and you turn it into thread, you get cotton cloth and you get blue jeans. But if you take cotton balls and you chop them up in hot water and you boil them for a while, and then you run them through ringers, like washing, old-fashioned washing machine ringers, you can produce very high-quality but inexpensive paper. And so cotton paper is one of the main kinds of paper that we have today. Most of the paper, when you go buy paper, it's generally from plant. It's made from plant fibers. It's cotton, it's linen, it's flax, and it's pretty cheap. It's good. It's durable and it doesn't bleed. If you print on one side, it doesn't show on the other side. So cotton paper really revolutionized paper and printing, and cotton paper was cheap. It wasn't as cheap as wood pulp paper, which was made out of sawdust, the same kind of thing. You take sawdust from lumber mills and you boil it and you mix it with, some chemicals, and you run it through a squeeze press and you get cheap paper. The kind that's, newsprint is made out of wood pulp. And cheap books were published on wood pulp paper, and that's where we get the phrase pulp fiction. It's because it was the kind of stories that was published on the cheapest kind of paper, wood pulp paper. But most paper now is made out of cotton and linen and flax.
Even though we don't have the leather covers, because back in the day, the elite could buy cotton linen paper between leather covers. And that was very expensive. You'd pay several months' wages for that.
The book business was always a business for the wealthy. You know, until the 1960s, really, books were expensive, and very few people had many books in their homes. If you wanted a book, you went to the library. But in the 1960s, the paperback revolution made books cheap enough for the baby boom generation, the post-World War II generation, to spend their allowances on cheap paperbacks. And the baby boomers loved books and bought tons of them. And that really made a proliferation of bookstores all over the country in the 1960s, as books became ordinary consumer items, not for the rich, but for everybody.
Well, and then I was also intrigued with the relationship of the Erie Canal and the publishing industry, because due to the Erie Canal, New York City became our nation's publishing capital after 1825. And I had just, you know, I've always grown up with New York City being the capital of our publishing. Your book has so many interesting facts in it that I think we've only scratched the surface, Michael. So I really think people who, if they're listening to this show, they not only love to read books, but they probably would like to write a book. So I think your book would be the very thing they need to go out and find. Thank you, Michael.
Well, I hope. Thank you for having me on, Nancy. I really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Again, the book is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing by award-winning journalist and author Michael Castleman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.